this was my identity.
Nobody talks about how freaking hard it is to be a dentist. What most people talk about is how this affects the patient. What nobody talks about is how this affects us. Dentistry is ready for this. Now is really the time. Welcome back to Wellness in Dentistry. I am Dr. Kyle Stanley, a dentist, tech entrepreneur, speaker, and researcher, and I am joined by your other co-host, Dr. Martin Mendelson. He is a disabled dentist, coach, speaker, and thought leader, and together, Martin and I have helped thousands of dental professionals pursue wellness in dentistry, something that is not focused on by many. But there is a growing number of dentists and dental professionals that are trying to pursue wellness. And this is wellness for the patients, of course, wellness for the practice from a business standpoint, and lastly, wellness for the practitioner. We need to be in a good, stable place in order to give our best to our patients. And if you're new to us and you'd like to look at what Martin and I do, you can go to wellnessanddentistry.com. When you're there in our links section, you're going to find our Lightside Live course. Now, this is coming out, you know, the first week of May, I think May 7th, and you have 2 days to book to get to Lightside Live on May 9th. In Irvine, California. So especially if you're local or if you're just a simple flight away, buy your ticket, fly tomorrow, cancel your patients, and join us on May 9th and 10th. We have a two-day 12 CE credit program. The first night we have a yacht party that's included. Super, super fun. So go to Wellness and Dentistry, look at our links. And Martin, today we're going to be talking about, or I guess asking this question of, can people outside of dentistry help us? Whether you're a consultant, whether you are a mental health professional, whether you are a leadership coach, should we only trust dentists because they really get it, or should we look outside of dentistry? And I know you and I have mixed feelings on this. I think we agree with each other, but we have mixed feelings and think that in some areas, we may want to only have dentists, and in some areas, we actually may want to look outside of dentistry and see what we can learn. What are your thoughts on this?
I think that, first of all, yes, 100% agree with what you just said. And the truth of the matter is that everyone knows that we were not taught leadership. We were not taught HR. We were not taught team cohesion lessons in dental school. So for those that do really well in this area that are dentists, some have natural inclinations, some have a lot of additional training that they've gone through, some it's a matter of both. And I think that the idea, particularly around consultants, that you can't trust a consultant unless they were a dentist, I think, to be blunt, is foolhardy. Because what I like to say, and I've said this before on this podcast, is that when the patient is reclined and their mouth is open, what we do is 100% unique. But everything that gets them to the chair, gets them paying for from a case acceptance perspective in the chair, and then paying their bill when they get out of the chair, isn't. And so I think it's a bit myopic to sit back and say that, you know, consultants aren't of value in this one example, unless they're a dentist. And this is coming from a dentist, as of course you are too. So yeah, what are your thoughts?
My first thought goes to what you and I say all the time, which is no one understands a dentist like another dentist.
Yep.
That is true.
Yeah.
No one knows what it's like to work on that patient that's a, you know, an upper second molar, that they still have their third molars, the buccinator muscles pulling the cheek onto the side, so you're wrestling with the mirror trying to retract this. You know, their tongue is going crazy. You touch the gums and they bleed. Your hygienist is coming and saying that you need an exam. Your husband and wife is calling you, asking you about what we're going to do with the kids this afternoon. I mean, no one understands that.
Yep.
However, there's people that understand and are professional and have skills that we never even considered.
Yep.
Because of what you just said, you know, we go to school for 8, 10, 12 years to learn dentistry. to learn clinical work, to learn specialty work, to learn, the lab side, for example. But when it comes to case acceptance, we may have had one professor that taught us one or two times when we were in the clinic how to do something, or maybe we learned a little bit as we were associate. There are people that are really, really good at this that may not be dentists. Just like how there are people that have spent their whole life working on leadership skills, and they have a lot to teach us. One thing that Martin and I always talk about is, I call it the dental success trio, is you really need your hand skills, your heart skills, and your head skills. And we only think or put time, money, and effort into our hand skills because we think skills are only for hands. But skills are for how you think about being present. Skills are for setting boundaries and expectations. Communication skills. I mean, these are things that we can learn from non-dentists.
And here's the other thing that I think certain individuals forget that are very indignant on this topic, which is this. Not only do certain, many consultants have skills that we don't have, they're also exposed to a multitude of dental practices over the years. And that in and by itself is gold because
So much value.
all we have as a frame of reference is our practice and the discussions we may have with friends and colleagues. These people not only have a, shall we say, bench of clients, if they're also engaged in their craft, like for example, going to, Speaking Consulting Network or going to, ADMC or even going to ADOM, then they get exposure exponentially to additional people with additional ideas. And you can't get that by staying in your practice. And so it's kind of like, in many ways, leaning on your lab technician relative to certain elements of the restorative process, not just in fabrication, but in, bonding protocols, you name it, because they see more cases in a day than most dentists do in a month, if not more, right?
That's exactly right. And I was just on a call this morning, as a clinical director of a lab, talking with a dentist, and they said that exact same thing. We were talking about an implant restoration. And they said, in your opinion, you guys do hundreds of these a day. What do you think would be the best design for this? They were concerned about how the emergence profile was, and I talked about from my own experience as a dentist, but also the hundreds that I've seen just this month in the lab. And it's exactly right. And that's a great point that you bring, is like I'll think of myself as an associate. I worked at a lot of practices. I worked at one time, I worked at 10 practices at one time. Because I was doing
I didn't
like,
know that. That's a
yeah, well,
that's...
because I was mostly doing specialty work.
Oh, okay.
So I would do like every Thursday at this place and every
Got
other
it.
Monday at this one. And I'd do twice a month at this one because I'd just come in and do sedations, or I'd come in and do implants, or I'd do wisdom teeth and sedations at this one. So because it was not general dentistry, that was why I worked at so many. But it gave me a lot of insight when I did start my practice into what I wanted, what I didn't want. So which software systems did I want to use? What hand pieces did I want to use? How did I like my assistants to talk to my patients? How did I like the setup of the room? So I got a good amount of exposure because I worked at so many practices. But even that is nothing compared to what a consultant that's been doing this for 20, 30 years, that's been in literally hundreds of practices, realizes. So I
And
think we
let's
need to get over our ego a little bit. Yes, we're not going to ask the consultant about a bonding system, right? We're not going to ask them which rubber dam clamps should we use because they're not experts in clinical dentistry. But they may be able to say, well, yeah, most of my clients actually liked this chair, and the patient said they really liked it.
Or let's give another example. I would hope you would ask a dental representative from a products company that you have a good relationship with that you feel is knowledgeable, what they think about, this product based upon its protocols and what they've seen. Like, let's say you're using Ivoclar products and you have this great Ivoclar rep and there's a lot of them out there. And you're like, well, what's your experience with this one particular product? Oh, okay. What are the pitfalls that you've observed, et cetera? It's the same relative idea about scaling yourself by availing yourself of people that have a multitude of different exposures. Let me give you a different example. Let me give you an example around thought process. And I'm using this one or sharing this one because every time I share it, no joke, 90 plus percent of the time, people say, I never thought of it that way before. And this is not my idea, so I got to give credit where credit's due. This was something MTS Manji said one time that blew my mind. So we've talked in the past that only 10% of dentists take any time off, right? So, and I've always said your practice production is based upon planning, and you'll live and die by your yearly plan. Well, if you're working, let's say, 3.5, 4 days a week, and you do that routinely, and you feel like you don't have any time to take vacation, what if 4 months of the year, you worked 5 days a week and took the last week off? It's the same production. The only difference is the days you're working because math, ladies and gentlemen, is math. And so I got to give MTS credit with this one. It wasn't my idea, but I think it's a brilliant concept. And this is one example because, he's consulted with thousands, if not tens of thousands of practices. It's just one example of the difference of thought that a broader exposure to, a multitude of offices can bring to you.
And going in the opposite way of this, yes, we can learn a lot from people outside of dentistry. But I still believe, and I think Martin, you'd agree with me, that when we're teaching mental health, and I'm not just saying this because me and Martin teach mental health, I think it is better to come from dentists because people are more receptive to it. And we've seen this with the ADA has done this, different state dental associations have in good nature tried to incorporate mental health training or e-courses, but there's not a dentist teaching it. And so you have a nurse teaching it, you have a medical doctor, you have a psychologist, you have a therapist, and they can all bring something unique, but still it's like they don't know what we're going through.
And
So, but what's funny is how Martin and I teach it and how others teach it, I think, is we take things from outside of dentistry, but then we apply them to dentistry with the understanding and the nuance that anybody as a dentist would be able to get. So it's like there are places in our profession where only, I believe, only should be taught by dentists. But when you think about a practice consultant, or when you think about anything non-clinical, they are the experts. They are the experts in this, and we can learn so much. And when you look at dentistry, most of us don't suffer clinically. Most of us are pretty darn good at making a denture, prepping a crown, restoring an implant, placing an implant, doing an extraction. Do we have complications? Yeah. Is every 10th case challenging? Yeah, it is. But in general, we don't suffer with that. I did a recent poll on my Lightside Academy Facebook group looking at what causes you the most stress, and it wasn't clinical. The first one was actually staffing. And when I see staffing, I don't actually think the problem is the staff. I think the problem is leadership abilities, communication skills, expectations, boundaries, right? And all of that stuff, in my opinion, should be taught by outside people.
Agreed. And going back to what you said about Lightside Live and mental health courses for dentists, what we're doing is not therapy. And that is in and needs to be and is rightfully so in the balance of therapists. What we're doing is we're talking about tips, tricks, and techniques and methodologies that come from the literature that are then applied, deployed, modified based on a dentist's understanding to help fellow dentists.
Yeah, I like how you said that because what it's doing is we're taking proven research from outside of dentistry, marrying it with our nuanced understanding of what a dentist goes through, and then teaching it in that way.
And there's a big difference. I mean, in my coaching practice as well, I'm very clear on the defining line between coaching and therapy. And I don't, from my observation, at least from private Facebook groups of coaches, not many people understand that. And I find that interesting because in my first certification, from my perspective, they were very clear on this. And coaching is not therapy. And there's differences that we don't need to get into here. But the point is that there's coping skills, there's burnout coping methodologies, there's burnout reducing or eliminating philosophies. And then there's therapy in another place. So yeah, nobody understands a dentist like a fellow dentist. And I find it really interesting because this whole discussion that we're Kyle and I are having here came about because I noticed again a couple posts on a couple dental Facebook groups kind of railing against, consultants that are not dentists. And I personally think that's incredibly myopic. And I also think that not every consultant is for every dentist, not every dentist is for every consultant either.
So you talked about the difference between therapy and coaching. What about the difference between coaching and consultants?
Well, so I would actually tease it out a little differently, coaching, mentorship, and consulting. So what I believe most dentists get confused around is when they're really indignant around a consultant should be a dentist, what they're really talking about is mentorship. Mentorship has been there, done that, bought the t-shirt. I'm going to share with you what worked for me, what didn't work for me, and what I've heard through the grapevine. A consultant is someone who's hired for a specific thing that has a specific agenda, i.e., focusing on X, Y, or Z, that's going to use their experience, their expertise, and their training and exposure to other dental practices to help you establish systems to bring you to a different place. Now, the last one, which is coaching, when or in its pure form, coaching is helping somebody get from A to B, whatever B is for them, without actually sharing your own experiences necessarily and playing the mentorship role. Now, when I work with my clients, we have this discussion up front relative to there are some times I'm going to be putting the mentorship hat on because I do have that ability. While at the same time, pure coaching is to help you get out of your own way because we all have the answers, we just don't realize we do.
Yeah, I'm thinking about Lightside Academy, my course, and how I would categorize that. And I think it's a little bit of both. It's probably similar to your individual coaching clients, where you're a coach 70% of the time and you're a mentor 30% of the time, and maybe mine's the opposite, right? Maybe mine's 70-30 the other way, or some mix of that. Yeah, that's it's a
Because
really interesting way of
oftentimes,
putting it.
I mean, because oftentimes people want to jump heavily into crucial conversations. Well, that's a mentorship thing. That's not coaching because I'm teaching you content that I've adapted, that I've used based on experience, been there, done that, bought the t-shirt, and then I'm helping you craft it in your own way for your own use, for you to move forward. So the again, when dentists get really hot under the collar about consultants not being dentists, what they're really talking about is mentorship, not consulting and not coaching.
Yeah, well, I know a consultant who works with, I think she only works with oral surgeons. And she was an office manager that turned into a consultant. She's wildly successful, and her clients, even more importantly, are wildly successful. And she's not a dentist, but in her case, she does know everything about how to build an oral surgery practice, about how to run study clubs, about how to do referrals, about how to schedule and get people in, about how to hire and fire, and how many assistants there should be at the front and in the back, and do we have an associate, and all of that. She's not an oral surgeon, she's not a dentist, but I know that I've talked to her clients and they're very thankful for her, and they all say, she grew my practice.
100%. 100%.
So that shows, I think, that you don't need to be a dentist. Do you think that this negative thought pattern or this negative connotation with having a consultant that's not a dentist, do you think it comes from ego?
I think it depends on the person. I think it either comes from ego, lack of experience of what a true high caliber consultant can do, or past experience with certain individuals that didn't serve them for whatever reason. And I don't know what the baseline reasons for that might be, whether it's what the consultant attempted to do, or frankly, did the dentist not implement properly or implement according to plan? Because that's another huge thing that I've experienced over the years, both in my current business, coaching with clients at Spear, coaching docs at the laboratory. Like in every situation I've ever been in, whether I'm in a coaching position, a mentorship position, or even consulting on occasion, the implementation piece or lack thereof is huge. And it's where most of us fall down, frankly.
That's so interesting what you're talking about with past experiences, right? Let's say someone had one consultant that was a dentist. They were great. So they're going to say every consultant needs to be a dentist. Or the opposite, they have one consultant that wasn't a dentist and maybe they were poor. And then they say, gosh, well, it's because he or she wasn't a dentist, right? And then I also love the implementation piece because, gosh, that is so true with any education. I remember when Christian Coachman first started traveling around and teaching DSD. So it was like 15 years ago. And the first 5 years, I mean, he was in like 50 countries. He was like literally everywhere teaching all the time. And then I remember seeing in 2015, and I think it was 2015, maybe it was 17. But he had been teaching, let's say, 5, 7 years, this concept. And they had trained thousands of dentists around the world, tens of countries. And they ended up going back and polling the people that had taken the course. And what they learned was only like 5% of people, I may be getting this wrong, but I think it was around 5%, had implemented what they taught. Everyone came in and was like, this is amazing. This is life changing. Oh my gosh, lab communication is going to be great. We're going to help, encourage more patients to do comprehensive treatment, facially driven treatment. Amazing. And then they get home and don't do anything. And when you think about that, is that Christian's fault or is it the doctor's fault? And so that was why Christian created the DSD clinics, which is really like kind of a mentorship program to have people come into your practice and implement what was being taught in the DSD day. And it's so interesting that you said that because that's the first thing that I thought about. And this has happened in my courses as well. I have people that they take the course, they say, this was incredible, this was life-changing, I loved it, I implemented everything, my whole life changed. And we have people that they take it 6 months later and they say, oh, I'm still on, module one. Or, yeah, I took everything. I'm just still waiting. I'm probably going to start applying some of this stuff. And guess what? They didn't make the change yet. The
And
content didn't change.
correct. And I think going back to your ego question too, I'm gonna flip the descriptor to, do we have a growth mindset around our attempts of implementation? So are we really being honest with ourselves? Did we actually implement in the best way possible? Did we not? What role do we play in the success or lack thereof of a given initiative? I had this experience at when I worked for what was called America's Clearwater at the time, now NDX Clearwater. And Mike Picos was very kind and he invited me to his study club, which has been around a long time. And so I would go to the meetings. And I will never forget this because remember, for those of you who are new, relatively new, Kyle and I both have experience of literally consulting on cases that were sent to the lab. So I have literally seen more preps than I ever would have seen as a practicing dentist practicing 40 years. In 2.5 years, I had 16,000 cases go through my hand. Yes, I counted. And so I have this vivid memory of being in Mike's practice. It was actually his lava was coming out, ironically
Oh,
enough. And it was a
wow.
3M night about lava. So, yes, I'm dating myself. And we're coming down the spiral staircase, and I'm behind two guys. And one dentist says to the other, "Hey, did you try that product, this restorative lab fabricated product that we talked about a couple of months ago?" "Yeah, why?" "Oh, that stuff's terrible. Like, I tried it twice and they both fractured." And I'm sitting here thinking to myself, well, whatever reason, we tend to underprepare based on manufacturers'
Recommendation.
protocols. And in fact, I know at Spear for years, when Gary DeWood and Bob Winter tag teamed the anterior restorative dentistry and the restorative dentistry, actually the restorative dentistry workshop, they literally did an experiment where they asked people to prepare, I think it was like 14 and 8 as they would typically prepare it. Then they would measure the reduction, and literally 90% of the class was underreduced. And so, long story short, that really sat with me because I wasn't judging the guy who said that material sucked. Far from it. I was just very curious relative to, did he evaluate his preparations? What information did he gain to make the decision that it was the product, not the preparation, not the impressioning, not the fabrication? I mean, my goodness, there's so many variables in a lab fabricated restoration. Just like there are so many variables in a clinical practice, are we being open, honest, and growth mindset enough that when things don't go well, instead of saying that sucked and it's a failure, to turn it around and go, okay, it failed. What happened? It's a very different discussion.
We see that all the time in clinical dentistry,
Yep.
right? We see this with, I was just talking about this with my dad, was when composites came out, everybody said, oh, well, these suck compared to amalgam. And they did. My
Yeah,
dad
they
was like,
did.
yeah, the old composites, they sucked. They were terrible. But then you finally had good composites on, but people still had this idea of, no, they're not as good as amalgam. And it's the same thing. Well, if you do them in a mouth with no rubber dam, if it's not dry, if you're not using the right curing light, if you're not using the right bonding system, yeah, they are gonna suck. But just like anything, like if you do anything poorly, it's not gonna turn out the right way. So I wanted to ask you, and I don't know if you have experience with this or maybe from Spear being a coach, but you were talking about, let's say, an example of a consultant. Let's say you have a consultant and he or she is there for 6 months. Is that enough to evaluate the time? Like, how long on a consultancy do you give someone before you realize, is it me? Is it them? It's like I think about a real estate agent on selling a house, right? How long do you give that real estate agent a chance before you try another one?
I think that's a brilliant question, and I'm going to answer it with one word or two words. It depends. And here's why I
You
say that.
bastard.
Here's why I say that. I think it really depends on what it is you're looking to do. If you're looking to push the needle on case acceptance, that's not necessarily going to, for the practice, that's not necessarily going to happen overnight. Number one. Number two, you need enough data to determine how things are going over X period of time. If you're talking about How you're answering the phone, if you're talking about conversion rates on the phone, those kind of things, that's a little quicker. And certainly in today's day and age, whether you're using somebody like Mango or Weave that has those AI call intelligence like features where they can actually give you a report of the calls without you having to sit and listen to all of them.
I'm going to be talking about that at California Dental Association on a panel, by the way.
Oh, nice. Very cool. It's great stuff. So I think it depends, but here's another way I would answer you. It is critically important to understand, A, what are the objectives of this consulting relationship? What are the measures of success? What are the responsibilities of the consultant? And what are the responsibility of the hiring practice? And I say it that way on purpose, because it may not be the dentist specifically. It could be the office manager or lead front office person, et cetera. So objectives, responsibility, and accountability are things that I don't think you can ever escape from in any kind of relationship. So even with coaching, yeah, I mean, most of my clients come to me somewhere around the idea that they feel stuck, they have trouble making decisions, they get stuck in their head, all of those kind of things. Well, as part of my intake process, and I know part of the intake process of a lot of my really great high caliber colleagues, we have discussions around what does success look like? And at the end of this time, if we were in a successful coaching client relationship, what would that look like? What would be the measures of success? Now, sometimes those measures can be subjective, but they still can be identified relative to, how you feel about having difficult conversations or how you feel about talking to patients about higher dollar procedures, those kind of things. So I think becoming objective in terms of deliverables and accountability on both sides is the most important factor.
I see it as expectations, again, one of my three tenets. And it's like how you talk about it when you're explaining to a new team member how to take x-rays or how to do the sterilize or how to set an appointment. You are establishing that it's as much on you. You're setting that psychological safety, but you're establishing those KPIs. You're going to say how often we're going to check in. What are the KPIs going to be? What's required by each relationship, each party? And that really has nothing to do with dentistry. That is just, like you said, relationship building, learning how to do contracts. I remember when we were starting, when my business partner and I, when we were starting our LLC and our doing our contracts when we were going to buy our practice. And I remember the lawyer saying, this contract, we have to think about this contract as if you guys are breaking up. So everything needs to be written in here. Who gets what? Can, do you have to sell to another, to the other party? Can you sell to a third party? Can a spouse own it if you pass away? All of these little things that at the time seem so silly. It's like, we're just starting this business. What do you mean? Like, we're not going to break up. And I'm so glad that we had that stuff in there because our relationship changed over time, mostly because I started doing less clinical work because of my work with Pearl and speaking and research and stuff. But I'm glad that we had that stuff in there. And Matt and I were very open about talking about this stuff. But that has nothing to do with dentistry.
And one of my dear friends and technically my first coach, Justin Patton, has, I have this saying branded into my brain, which is transparency builds trust. And if you're feeling squirrely about, or the other party is in a dental practice contract, and the other party is feeling squirrely about putting all these things in writing, the first question is why? Because at the end of the day, no one knows what's going to happen tomorrow. And, God forbid, you may not be here tomorrow. And so, why would you not, as an act of kindness, service, or even love, if you want to go there, relative to this other person, that you trust enough to be engaged in whatever kind of partnership with, why would you not want to put that down in writing? Like, it doesn't, if we're truly honest with ourselves, you can't come up with a reason why that wouldn't make sense. And I would argue with you even over the, well, you know, we don't want to make things too complicated. We trust each other, et cetera, et cetera. Great. So then if that's the case, you should have absolutely no problem putting it in writing. Like, it's just,
That's true. Yes.
yeah, I don't accept any other answer for that. I'm sorry.
Most practice consultants, I believe, are brought on to grow the practice. Now, usually that means from a financial standpoint. So they're coming in, and the KPI tends to just be production or collections. And so it tends to be fairly easy to measure over time. I brought this person in March. We were doing whatever, $100,000 a month. By June, we were doing 120. By September, we were doing 180. After 2 years, we were doing 200 a month. That seems to be fairly easy to measure. I think what's more challenging, and this is on the consultant side, is coming in and finding out what they need to change. And also doing it in a stepwise fashion so that it's not overwhelming for people. Because I know I've been in as an associate when consultants come in and just try to change everything all at once. And that's overwhelming for team members.
Absolutely.
Have
And
you seen that?
oh yeah, 100%. And part of it is you need to read the room. I mean, there are individuals that are excited, engaged, feel a sense of ownership that can handle that. And there's a lot of people that can't, and there's no right or wrong here. So yes, in general, when we talk about change facilitation, the better, the wiser way to go is stepwise for a whole bunch of reasons, right? And so we need to read the room relative to the individuals involved. But in most cases, the default would 100% be, slow and steady wins the race, period.
That may be hard for dentists that are hiring somebody because, you're hiring a consultant and, they're 10K a month, or let's say, I don't know, we'll throw out a number. And you're like, gosh, this is 10K a month. He or she needs to, I need to make 20K more just so that I can make 10K more after paying him or her. And so it is a lot of pressure, but I've seen, it's, gosh, it's just like anything. If you put money into something, you put time and effort into something, there is going to be a change.
Yeah, 100%.
The biggest problem that I've seen with consultants is the person is hiring the consultant to make the change instead of diagnose, treatment plan, and train for that. And let's say the dentist owner doesn't want to change anything themselves. They want the consultant to change everybody else. And that can be a lack of self-awareness.
And you just proved why I said what I said about how important understandings are in writing in the beginning relative to what you're going to do, what the measurements of success are, what the responsibilities are of both parties, how each party is going to hold each other accountable. Because that's where the rubber meets the road.
Well, I mean, we've seen this in technology. With any kind of technology, you get a dentist and he or she goes to these CE courses. Maybe they have an amazing speaker like me, haha. And they're showing some great technology and say, oh my gosh, that's amazing. We have to implement that. And they buy it, they get it, whether it's a printer or scanner or whatever. And then the problem is implementation.
Oh, 100%.
The problem is not buying the scanner or something. It is teaching your team, trying it out, finding the nuances, finding what works, where do we keep it? Do we roll it around? Do we take it to each individual office or each individual operatory? All of those little things. And I've seen this from an AI side. And that's one of the things that I like about AI is that there's not a lot of change management that needs to happen. I didn't even know this word of change management until I got into the tech world and was selling to thousands of doctors, basically, or practices. But you start, I remember when we first were talking to a DSO and they said, well, what's the change management on this? And I didn't know what they were talking about.
Well, and it actually, ironically enough, all goes back to the science of habits. And if you haven't read the book Atomic Habits, I would strongly recommend you do. And in there, he has a graph that explains what you just said about the timeline of implementation or the timeline of change, excuse me. And James Clear calls it the plateau of latent potential. And it's a graph of time on the Y versus change on the X. And basically, people think that, you're going to get this immediate upward linear movement of change. And he says, no, it's not the way it works. In the beginning, you get next to no change, then it starts to improve, then it goes to all about, 75 degrees, and then you end up crossing and surpassing the expectation line. But the gap between the expected and the actual is a area that he calls the valley of disappointment. And we get caught in the valley of disappointment because we're not, to your question again about how long, we're not giving it enough time for the change to be implemented. Even, when you were talking about bringing technology into practice, my brain went back to so many conversations I've had over the years where, people bought some type of CAD CAM device and a quote sat in the corner.
And collect
Well,
the dust.
whose fault is that, right? And so that also, ironically enough, can go back to the science of habits because what I teach, because I teach this stuff too, is the idea that you already have all the processes and procedures set up in your office for every single thing you do. And when we talk about change facilitation or change implementation, if we can look at it from the idea of habit stacking, as James Clear calls it, habit integration versus habit change, then we're going to have a lot easier time doing it. So take, Pearl as an example, AI reading radiographs. You're going to read the radiographs anyway. You're going to talk to the patient about reading said radiographs anyway. Now we're using technology to do so. So then the question becomes, okay, what's the cue to use it and to start talking about it? What's the routine relative to showing and discussing? And then what's the reward for doing that? Assumedly increased case acceptance and of course increased patient knowledge. But if we don't look at it from the standpoint of, okay, when do we start doing this? How do we do it? And what do we expect to get out of it? Then we're going to get stuck in the valley of disappointment every single time. And it's ironic how this can be applied to anything in a dental practice.
I
Anything.
love that explanation. As you were explaining that, it totally makes sense. I was listening to a podcast last night and they were quoting Steve Jobs, who says people overestimate what they can do in a day and underestimate what they can do in 10 years. And it's kind of the same thing, right? And of course that's a little extreme in 10 years, but you overestimate what you can do in a month, let's say, and underestimate what you can do in a year, right? And that's exactly it. So what final thoughts do you have on this topic?
I think that my final thought, and this just kind of came to me out of nowhere, is if you can approach the idea of working with consultants, working with outsiders. Let's forget about continuing to label it consultant. Outside support, outside professional support. If you can look at this from the lens of a clinical procedure, what does success look like? What does the end goal look like? Great. How am I going to get there? How long is it going to take? Do I need to phase the treatment? That shift in mindset alone can really increase the success, optimization, utilization of any outside expert that you choose to engage in.
Yeah, and I think my final thoughts with this is most dentists suffer from non-clinical topics,
Yeah.
and most people who are experts in non-clinical topics are not dentists.
Yeah.
And so, because of that, I believe the people that incorporate those from the outside world, let's say, are more likely to excel.
Totally. Agreed. Agreed, agreed.
Fantastic. Well, everybody, I think it's March 7th that you're listening, or no, May 7th
May
that you're listening to this.
7th.
So that means you need to buy your ticket to Lightside Live. You need to fly tomorrow, if you're not in Southern California, to Irvine. We're right by Disneyland and the beach, and come to Lightside Live. It's the coolest course around. It's a very transformational course, and we'd love to see you there. You can go to wellnessanddentistry.com. Find the link to that, all of mine and Martin's links as well. And as always, we thank you guys for listening and would appreciate if you sent this to a colleague who may need to hear this. We'll see you on the next episode of Wellness and Dentistry.
Bye-bye.